Welcome back to Hash Rate Up. Today is all about Bitdia. I sat down with Harris Bassett, CSO, Chief Strategy Officer at Bitdia, to talk about Bitdia, presenting their company and also talking about vertical integration and where they're taking vertical integration with regards to their ASIC development that they have recently announced. They announced a target of 5 joules per terahash. I wanted to know more. Hash Rate Up starts now. Enjoy. All right, folks. Like I said in the brief introduction, I'm here today with Harris, CSO of Bitdia, Chief Strategy Officer. Our hash price currently is at 48. We're in the deep into the pain zone once again, below the 50 mark on the per petahash per day. 14-day exahash rate is at 574, and we are block height 849,590. Harris, thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Jesse. I'm happy to be here.
Great. To jump into it, I was hoping, Harris, to meet you in Vegas or now at the Disrupt. You're at neither. How come? You don't like going to events too much? What's happening?
I've traveled a lot in the first part of this year. And so I gave myself a little bit of a travel break in June. And so I traveled a little less in June, and then July is probably going to pick up again. So just wanted to spend more time at home, and nothing other than that.
Yeah, get some actual work done, right? Not just jump around at events and eat fancy food. July is Nashville, I'm presuming, or where are you going?
Yeah, definitely will be in Nashville in July. There are a few other locations. I have to check my calendar, but Nashville is the main one towards the end of July.
Cool. I'm unfortunately not coming, but I'm sure our paths will cross somewhere at some stage.
Sure, absolutely.
Harris, do you mind giving folks a brief introduction to yourself, how you stumbled across Bitcoin? Keep it very brief. I'm sure you've done this many times before. And same goes for Bitdia. Where does the company come from? What do you guys focus on?
Okay, let me start with myself. Harris Bassett, as you said, my background is really chip design, semiconductor, device physics, things like that. I've been involved. I'm a pretty old guy now. I've been involved in this for a long time. Back in graduate school, I worked on ultra bright LEDs that allowed LEDs to be visible in a bright room or even outside at hundreds of yards. You know, they're used now for traffic lights and brake lights and things like that. A lot of the device physics that went into making that possible was done by a team that I worked on at University of Illinois. Then I've been involved in the chip design business pretty much since then at IBM's research labs, at Bell Labs, at Rockwell Science Center. And a lot of that time was working on more esoteric things at the time. So gallium arsenide, before it became very common. Right now it's in everyone's cell phone, but when I was working on it, it was something that might only last in the lab for a few minutes before it degraded. So that became very widely used as well. I started a company from some innovators in England, brought them over to Silicon Valley, started that company in 2004, sold it in 2012. It had a timing technology that is still, I think, the best way to do very accurate, precise timing on silicon. I sold that company to Analog Devices in 2012. Been involved in a few other semiconductor related things. I was helping a friend of mine teach entrepreneurship at Berkeley back in 2011, 2012. And some of my students came to me in 2014 with an idea for a Bitcoin mining ASIC. At that point, nobody had ASICs for Bitcoin mining. A lot of people were thinking about it, but no one really had it. And so I put their ideas together with some ideas that I had from designing silicon or chips for military applications and came up with a new technique for designing these chips that are really very specific to Bitcoin. And we developed those in 2014. They got adopted widely, and pretty much the whole industry is using those techniques now for the last 10 years, mostly around those techniques. And so that was my introduction to Bitcoin back in 2014. I went off and did other things. And then about a year and a half ago, Jihan Wu, the founder of Bitmain and now Bitdeer, approached me about doing some advanced chip development at Bitdeer for the, you know, the subsequent generations of ASIC technology. So that's my background. You know, had side gigs in agriculture and things like that that probably we can go into it on some other podcast. But then Bitdeer has been around a long time. We've probably been mining longer than any other publicly traded Bitcoin mining company. However, we've only been public for a year. And so we, you know, we're part of Bitmain, we were mining as part of Bitmain since 2013, really. And we split off from Bitmain as a separate company in 2020. So we've only been an independent company for about, you know, a little over 4 years now, and a public company for about 1 year. So that's basically the history of both myself and Bitdeer.
Very, very interesting. What made you guys go public so late? Because most folks, right, they start out, they have a bit of capacity, and then they need cash flow to invest, you know, into larger CapEx projects. What made you guys go public? Was there any specific project that sure. Made you do so?
Well, I mean, I think it just took longer than we expected. It's not easy to go public as a Singapore headquartered Bitcoin mining company on NASDAQ. So that process took maybe a year or even more than a year, longer than we expected. So I think it's just that additional
waiting time.
Yeah.
And are you guys, how many exahash do you guys have under management today?
I think it's just right around 22 or in that range.
And then you are exahash. 22, right? And you guys are heavily geographically diversified. I think you have that. Maybe only Marathon sort of can keep up with that, because I know you've got at least three continents covered, right? Because you're always also mining with Bhutan. Give us a brief overview over that. Like, where are you guys spread out all across the globe?
Yeah, as you mentioned, we have multiple sites, like I think six sites or more on three continents. Let me just start with the US. So that's our primary concentration in terms of Bitcoin mining. And our largest site in the U.S. is in Texas, Rockdale, just outside of Austin, about an hour east of Austin. And that's a little over 500 megawatts of mining capacity there. Then we have a site in Tennessee, which is a little over 80 megawatts, 85 megawatts. I don't remember the exact number. We have a site in Washington State, which is fairly small, 13 megawatts. And then we have announced sites in Ohio for 221 megawatts. And we've have additional sites in Ohio that we will announce later that are also very large. So that's our sort of U.S. footprint. Outside of the U.S., we have had for some extended period of time now two sites in Norway. They are add up to about 130 megawatts right now. We're adding another 170 megawatts there over the next 12 months or so. So those sites are actually really good. It's our, I think we have one of the larger footprints in Europe. And Norway is a great place, by the way. It's all hydroelectric there, called, you know, carbon-free clean power. And then in Bhutan, that's another location where it's all carbon-free, you know, hydroelectric power. We have two sites in Bhutan. One site is 100 megawatts. That's been up and running since August of 23. We have a second site that's 500 megawatts that we're in development now. that should be up and running towards the middle of 25. So, you know, less than a year from now, and probably fully up and running about a year from now.
So that's an that's easily 2 gigawatts, right? Total?
Well, no, that's the sites that are up and running already are 895 megawatts. If you add the 500 megawatts in Bhutan, you add another 170 megawatts in Norway that's going to come online, and then the Ohio site, that gets us to about 2 gigawatts by the end of 25. And if you go beyond 25, it's closer to, you know, it's much larger still, but those are sites we haven't announced yet.
Amazing. I mean, you got to keep the share of the pie the same, right? Everybody's growing, so you got to constantly move
well,
up.
We're actually very selective about where we mine. We have dozens, might be 100 or more proposals for mining locations in a year. And we are very selective. We want a place that's politically very stable, economically very stable, because, you know, we're going to invest hundreds of millions of dollars in those sites. And we really just don't want them to be at risk from political or economic instability. So that's first thing. Low cost of energy, of course, is important. Long-term contracts for low-cost energy. So, you know, we are actually quite selective about how we choose sites, and we have to be able to scale those sites now to fairly large, you know, 100 megawatts and above. Otherwise, it's also less interesting to us. So I'm sure we're going to expand. We like geographical diversity because in addition to each location being politically stable and economically stable, by having many locations that are geographically and jurisdictionally diverse, you protect the company even more. You know, if something you know, happens in Texas with regard to climate or energy, and the climate for Bitcoin mining becomes, you know, less positive there, then we still have all these other sites, and so, you know, we have an ability to decrease our risk by spreading out our mining sites.
I mean, that's what it's all about, right? But I know, Harris, my audience is itching, and if I don't ask, they will be very upset with me. When it comes to Norway and expanding there, the recent news out of the government that, you know, there has to be reports about who's cryptocurrency mining, and, you know, there has to be the availability for the government to, or the municipalities, to turn off the data centers. What does that make you guys think when you think about expansion? Does it make you more careful, or do you know it's not going to be that bad because you have special relationships on the ground? How do you see that?
I mean, I don't know about special relationships. We have close relationships with the local governments there. And, you know, we're working on projects that allow the waste heat to be used by the local municipalities. And so we're very close to the local governments. We are tracking that. We're not, you know, overly worried about it. We think that, you know, governments have a responsibility to make sure that their grids are stable. And we think we add to that stability. So I think, you know, over the long term and even the medium term, we will be an integral part of that system. But, you know, I think it's, every government has responsibility to look into that and to make sure that all players in that space are reliable and adding value.
Yeah, I mean, you nailed it right there. I mean, that has kind of been my belief now for a short time, that all of these guys to become bigger, you know, have to integrate locally, you know, produce heat. Finland, I'm really bullish on, you know, got the great demand response programs, cheap power, and that integration to the local district heating networks really makes things work, and sort of puts mining right in the center of the energy industry, and where you can hardly get rid of it anymore once it sort of delivers a massive benefit to local societies. Harris, let's talk about vertical integration a bit more. I want to cover this next point under that topic as well, because I kind of see it fitting in. The Bitdeer cloud hash rate, when you go to your website, you know, people can start mining one click, commonly referred to as cloud mining. How do you guys see that side of your business, and why do you choose to do that? Because essentially it's very similar to hash rate derivatives, right? You're effectively selling hash rate forward to your clients that pay you for it, and then they mine and take the risk of the hash price volatility. Is that a fair summary, or do you see it different?
I mean, we're renting time on a machine, basically. So, you know, how that machine performs is, you know, a shared risk between us. So I'm not sure I would see it exactly that way as a, you know, a security or a derivative. And I don't think I'm really qualified to make those judgments. We have lawyers for that. But it provides a very valuable service to our, you know, clients that choose that, because they can start mining very quickly. They can, if they're very small and they want a fraction of a machine, they can do that. If they want to do it for a month, or if they want to do it for a year, they can rent the machine for, you know, or 3 years, they can do any of those. They can rent hundreds of machines if they want. So it's a very flexible way of getting into mining for a lot of people, for a lot of institutions as well. You know, I think it's got a lot of value there. As we start selling mining rigs, it's also another way of improving our offerings to the community as well. So I think there's a lot to be said for that. The way we use it is a way of reducing volatility or exposure to volatility for Bitdeer. So we emphasize different products at different times, right? So right now, as we're going from a bear market towards a bull market, we believe over the next several months, we are pushing more of the self-mining hash rate. And then in the depths of the bear market, we usually rely a lot more on hosting, just straight hosting. And then at the peak, or maybe a little past the peak, the cloud hash rate product really does take off at that time. We're often able to lock in long-term contracts at the peak. A lot of the contracts that we have now for cloud hash rate were signed in, you know, 21 during the last peak. And so it helps reduce our volatility and, you know, generate revenue over the different parts of the four-year Bitcoin cycle. And it offers, you know, many different ways for our customers to expose themselves to mining.
Yeah, it's a super interesting approach. I mean, just being able to say, hey, we have hosting, self-mining, this is an income source, and depending on where the hash price takes us, we can, you know, switch strategies. I think that's not a lot of folks focus on that. At least I have not heard about it. Harris, brilliant. Under the same sort of umbrella of up and down hash price volatility, you could place ASIC price indices and ASIC pricing. That is kind of another derivative of Bitcoin. When is the right time to buy ASICs, in your opinion?
Well, I mean, you know, I think it's hard to say, right? I mean, there are two time constants at play that, you know, if you really want to capture this, right, there's a time constant in terms of how quickly Bitcoin price can move. And, you know, it can move several percent, or even, you know, 10% or 20%. In a day, right? It can move a lot very quickly. And then the overall global hash rate takes months to change, because you actually have to physically install machines, you have to access more power. It can go down much faster than it can go up, of course, because you can just shut things off in a few minutes. But so, you know, I don't believe in timing it. I think the best time to mine is all the time. You know, the best time to order machines is now, and then just start using them. If you believe in Bitcoin long term, which I do, then, you know, you just should start and get going. But if you're trying to time it, which again, I don't really advocate, if you can capture those disruptive times when the Bitcoin price has moved up rapidly, but the hash rate hasn't caught up, and you can deploy mining rigs right then. That's the best time to make the maximum profit from mining. Eventually, because the Bitcoin price is up, people, a lot more mining rigs will come online, and that benefit will decrease. But you know, if you can take advantage of that time, then that's the best time.
Understood. The seal miner that you guys have come out with, that's the biggest topic I want to cover today. Can you elaborate on that? First question, why did you decide to produce your own ASICs?
So every company sort of has a DNA to it, right? A thing that they're great at or best at. And for us, it's definitely the hardware side, making mining rigs and technology. And, you know, some of the other companies, they come from energy or power background. They were, you know, operators in the traditional power world, and they understand that. Some of the others are basically good at, you know, capital raises. They come from investment banking background, and they're good at that. So our strength and the moat around our company really is technology. And we are, my own background is deep into high tech and to semiconductor technology. I mentioned the 2014 architecture that a team I put together developed. And Jihan Wu, our founder, our chairman, our CEO, his background is in Bitmain, where he founded and basically grew the largest mining company or hardware company for mining in the world. And so that's really our strength. And even our chief business officer, Matt Kong, he's got a technology background. So we're playing to our strength, and which is to develop new breakthrough technology that will put a moat around our company, allow us to have a long-term high gross margin business. And that's really important, because if you think of Bitcoin mining, just a traditional Bitcoin miner, right? They are mining a commodity. Bitcoin is a commodity. All Bitcoin are identical to each other. And then they are using commodity energy, you know, and that energy price, some are a little lower, some are a little higher. But over time, that's going to level out, because the higher priced energy folks will not be mining as much or not be in business. And then they're buying hardware that's a commodity from one of, you know, three or four vendors. So that business looks a lot like a utility over the long term. There's very little the management can add other than efficiency of operations, which is a big thing, you know, but it's not, there's a lot of people that can do that, and just procuring scale and low cost capital. And that's not, I mean, we do all of those things well, but the thing that we are excellent at, that we're world leaders at, is developing new technology, breakthrough technology. And so once we do that, that puts a deep moat around our company that allows us to sell mining rigs. And selling mining rigs, as opposed to using mining rigs, has significant advantages. Those advantages are really, you know, the benefit of being able to put together leading edge technology teams, because designing an ASIC for a Bitcoin mining rig is one of the hardest chip designs you can do. I mean, it's easy to get one that works. Getting one that's highly efficient is super hard. And so that is where, you know, we expect our value add to this industry to be, and the one that's gonna, you know, generate profits for our shareholders. And a few points here, right? By making our own mining rigs, our mining operations become much more efficient, because we can now procure mining rigs at a fixed low price. Whether there's a big demand for mining rigs or not, the price of the mining rigs that we procure for ourselves will be more or less flat, because, you know, the foundry will charge us the same for the wafers, no matter what the Bitcoin is doing at the time. So we have that, where we don't have to pay excessive prices during times of high demand. And if you go back and you look at the previous boom cycle, a very large percentage of the profits went directly to the mining rig manufacturers like Bitmain, as opposed to the people who were buying the rigs to use them. And that's because they know at the time they're selling it, how much profit you can expect to make, and they can just mark up accordingly. So selling mining rigs allows us to have availability for ourselves. It makes our self-mining much better. It makes our hosting much better because now we can offer more services to our hosting clients. We can offer them a site, energy, and we can say, look, by the way, you can also buy mining rigs from us directly. And so it's much more vertically integrated. It's much more full service. And then, of course, selling mining rigs into the merchant market, we think we're going to have by far the most efficient rigs. That will allow us to value price them as opposed to pricing them like a commodity, because we should be saving our customers a tremendous amount in energy costs, and some of that a benefit we're hoping to capture for the company. So the ability to value price that, use our technological expertise to improve shareholder value through delivering state-of-the-art, you know, the most energy efficient products we can. I think it's a way of distinguishing ourselves from the rest and having, you know, I really think we're the only technology company that's in publicly traded in the Bitcoin mining space. The rest are operators. Some of them are very good operators, but they're not really technology companies in any significant way.
Yeah, it's like you said, right? You can only get so good with operations, and a lot of your operations is informed by the machines that you run. And I think as a Bitcoin miner, it's hard to get more vertically integrated than, hey, let's produce our own, right? And kind of produce them for us where we know where our strengths are and how we can operate them the best and remove that variable. You said something very interesting earlier. You said it's very hard to design good chips for Bitcoin mining. Everybody can do one, but it's hard to do a good one. Why do you think that is?
The techniques that people are using for Bitcoin mining are way beyond any of the techniques that people are using to design a chip for Apple or Nvidia or things like that. And part of that is that we can get away with more than they can, right? We can get away with chips that perhaps, you know, are not. Well, anyway, the nature of Bitcoin mining is such that it allows you to get away with a few more tricks. But it, you know, we were working at much lower voltages than typical chips that we have to deal with, just a much higher efficiency. So if you wanted to just start a company and do Bitcoin mining, you could just go to TSMC. You could use their building blocks and synthesize a chip and have it out there in weeks, literally. Tape it out. You know, it'd take 3 months for TSMC to get you back a chip. It would guarantee to be working. It also guaranteed to have way too much power consumption. So if you just use the building blocks that TSMC gives you, you will not have a competitive chip. So you really have to go back and design your own building blocks from the transistor and wire level up, right? So most people designing a digital chip will use logical building blocks that TSMC gives them. Things like AND gates, OR gates, you know, adders, mm-hmm. Multipliers, things that are higher level logic functions. When you're designing a Bitcoin chip, you have to go back down to the transistor level and every transistor, every wire. And it's a much more difficult task. It requires a lot more creativity to get that energy savings.
So you're saying everybody that's currently building chips or designing them is thinking inside the box. And you got to go and step outside of it and take what's not yet available, build it yourself as a component, and then do make your chips from that. Is that a correct, fair summary?
So, I mean, what I'm saying is that a typical digital chip outside of the Bitcoin space uses the building blocks that the foundry gives you, mostly. And in Bitcoin, you couldn't do that. But if you did it, you would not have a competitive chip in terms of its energy efficiency.
I understand that, but what is the competition doing today?
So they are doing some of that, right? I mean, the more aggressive competition are building their own building blocks. But even that has many levels of what you can do, right? How different are these building blocks from standard design? How creative are you being? So, you know, the thing is, everyone has access to the same manufacturing technology from TSMC or UMC or, you know, Intel or Samsung, whoever you choose to use. those, you know, the factory, the foundry for the semiconductors is the same. It's a level playing field in that sense, right? Maybe some people can get more wafers than others, but otherwise that's the same. So all the creativity comes in the design, mm-hmm. the benefits that you can do there. And so that's where you really have to shine. You have to be able to, you know, create a design that is just much more energy efficient. That takes a huge amount of creativity to do that.
Interesting. Yeah. Okay. So talk to me about the CL01. That's out today, right? I can purchase that. Is that correct?
Well, we're using the CL01 for our internal use only, really. So it's okay. It's, you know, we're going to be shipping it in volume to ourselves in August, and so that's not really meant for external use. Now, the CL02, 03, 04 are definitely going to be sold to clients, as well as we're going to use them ourselves internally. So the CL01 was a design that our group in Singapore did that is meant to be an early entry for ourselves to get into the market, to understand a lot of the whole system around putting it together. It's a lot more than the chip, right? It's the whole system. It's the software. It's the box that it goes into. It's the printed circuit boards. And we wanted to make sure all of that was good, where, you know, you can call it a test, but it's tens of thousands of units that we'll be using internally. And improvements on that basic design is CL02 and CL03. And okay. Then CL04 is a complete new revamp of the design methodology for Bitcoin mining.
We're going to get to CL04. I'm very excited to hear about it. I just want to cover something else first. But what you just said is also super important, right? You're doing this for the first time, so you got to figure out the supply chain first, right? Where do we get the boxes from?
Yeah, How do we put it in the box? The supply chain, there's a lot of kinks to get ironed out. And, you know, it actually turned out quite a bit smoother than we had anticipated. So, you know, it's looking good. And, but the first one we wanted to not do super high volumes, just tens of thousands of rigs, and then just do it internally.
Yeah.
That's a nice thing about having both mining and manufacturing, is that we always have a home for mining rigs that we can use even in market goes.
So when it's about your philosophy around the designs, Harris, right? What do you guys choose to focus on? What's sort of the most important variable? Is it efficiency, or is it robustness so that your operations becomes easier? What is the sort of at the forefront of all of this? Is it a mix?
Well, you can't ignore robustness or any of those things, but efficiency is the number one thing, right? So the thing is that efficiency is the headline number for any of the mining rigs, right? You can calculate immediately how many dollars and cents that means. But you also need to be as robust as possible. And of course, there's a minimum level of robustness. And so having said that, I don't want to minimize, stability and robustness. And that's a big part of why we're shipping all the first generation to ourselves, is that we want to make sure we understand that and we can make these as stable and as robust as possible. And stable and robust over a wide range of, environmental temperatures and uses. So that's important to us. As an operator, we understand why that's important and why that also affects dollars and cents that you make in terms of your profit. And so it's probably a close second. So, and the other thing, of course, is cost, right? How much does this thing cost, and how good of a value is it to your customers and to yourself?
Yeah, no, I mean, there's a reason why when it comes to mining in Africa, which is something that I frequently try to promote and advocate for, we mostly choose one company over the other here, because we understand efficiency on rack after 2 years is a lot more important than efficiency on paper when you buy the machine, right? But you can't get that thinking out of the market, I think, anytime soon, where you know, the lower efficiency number wins out, because it's very tough to sell the idea of, hey, you know, what if this machine is actually not that efficient because it's off for 10% of its lifetime, right? Or it has to be repaired or this or that, right? Yeah, very interesting.
Also, but efficiency is, you know, we report a single number, but efficiency is really very much environmentally dependent, temperature dependent, things like that. So you need to understand the actual realized efficiency of the machine and not just the headline number.
Okay, but you guys are focusing on efficiency, robustness, close second, cost as well. Understood.
Yeah.
The SEAL04, 5 joules per terahash. First, there's the remind me, the SEAL02 and the SEAL03, where you guys advocate, because you put a graph out there out early, right?
With targets. SEAL02 is, I think it might have already been taped out, or, well, it will tape out soon in this quarter, Q3. And that's the chip. We'll have the shipping that product in volume towards the end of Q4. So production volumes in Q4 of this year for SEAL02. SEAL03, the chip itself comes out at the end of this year, but it ships in volume towards the second quarter of 25. SEAL04, the chip comes out second quarter of 25 and ships in volume at the end of 25. So, you know, we put out the chip dates also because internally we're heavily focused on that. But from the market's point of view, it's when we're shipping in volume the actual mining rigs. And so that is SEAL02 would be Q4 of this year. SEAL03 would be Q2 of 25. And SEAL04 is Q4 of 25.
And talk to me about cooling, Harris, because I when you look at the miners out there, the lower efficiency machines will all be sort of hydro-cooled. How do you guys think about cooling? Why is cooling so important? And why does it have such an effect on efficiency? And is a 5 joule per terahash ASIC air-cooled, yes or no?
Yes.
Lots of questions there, sorry.
The last one, 5 joules per terahash can be... The design is, it's still more than a year off, but the design is intended to be air-cooled with that efficiency. Wow. And let me talk about why temperature and thermal is so important for cooling. So there are multiple ways of the power being used when a chip is operating. So there's the actual switching power, as you know, internally nodes are going from one voltage to another, let's just say logic levels from 0 to 1 and 1 to 0, back and forth, right? Each time one of those switches happens, there's something called switching power. And that, ideally, that is most of your load. But as the temperature goes up, you have what's called leakage power. You have current flowing even when no switching is happening, and even when switching is happening. And that leakage current is exacerbated by two things. The smaller process node, so you know, if you go to 3 nanometer, you have a lot more leakage than you do at, like, say 5 nanometer. And then it's also exacerbated by temperature. This leakage is really a quantum mechanical effect. It's saying that, hey, the barrier is high, but because it's such a thin barrier, such a narrow barrier, there's some probability that this electron can get through, even though it doesn't have enough energy to get through. And that probability of the electron getting through increases with temperature, increases exponentially with temperature. And so you increase 10 degrees Celsius, the leakage current can double, or in that range. And so as you increase the temperature, that power that's sort of dissipated all the time by the chips just leaking, leakage current, increases. And so the efficiency goes down because that leakage is not helping you calculate any hash.
Can I ask something quickly, Harris? Does that also increase the amount of invalid hashes that the chip produces when the electrons leak through the barrier?
No, it doesn't. I mean, at some point, at some temperature, chips will fail and will start generating incorrect results. Typically, they will shut off before doing that. But yes, at some point, you know, at some temperature, chips will start giving you incorrect results. That's not what I meant. You just get more leakage current, which means you have power dissipation that's really not improving your hash rate, but it's just there because it's hot. And if you have liquid cooling, you know, immersion cooling, hydro cooling, you can limit the maximum temperature that the chip experiences. And so you can say, hey, it's never gonna get the semiconductor junction, which is the important location here, will never get hotter than this because I'm going to have this liquid that's within a few microns of it all the time, taking heat away. And so if you can limit that top temperature, you can limit the leakage current. And so the efficiency of the chip is better. Furthermore, if you know when you're designing the chip that you will never experience a temperature above a certain level, you can change the design to not have to accommodate that leakage current, and that can improve efficiency also. So it can help after the fact, after the design, in reducing leakage current. And if you know that you'll never get above a certain temperature while you're still doing the design, you can change the design to make it more efficient. So there's a temperature plays a really big role, like I said, an exponential role in any electronics, not just Bitcoin mining, all electronics. In fact, even lifetime, if you increase the temperature of any piece of electronics by 10 degrees Celsius over its lifetime gets cut in half.
Wow. Okay, so that's crazy. I've never heard that before. So where can you push a 5 joule per terahash ASIC if you immerse it? What do you think?
So we're not giving out those numbers right now. I mean, we expect the 5 joules per terahash to be a reasonably conservative number that people will actually realize for most operating conditions. And so under ideal operating conditions, it'll of course be a little bit better than that.
Man. Okay. And the power, is it similar power draws to the ASICs on the market, which would then mean what, 1.5 petahash maybe in the future, not so long until one machine puts out that number?
Well, I mean, we haven't designed the boards or the machine that go with that chip yet. So that chip could be released in many different form factors in terms of what the total, you know, rate of hash rate is for the product that the chip is released on. It could be the way you said, it could be different than that. You know, there are other ways of releasing it. And we're looking also at, you know, eventually getting out of that shoebox type of design and doing more industrial type of designs that are just basically more robust, easier to maintain, easier to and have less fewer components to worry about.
We're already seeing that change, right? The rack units, the M63s from MicroBT and stuff like that.
Yeah.
See the form factor change. The size on the chip, Harris, can you talk about that for a brief moment? I think we're at like 4 or 3 nanometers, depending. Is there a physical limit to the downside of how small chips can be before they start failing?
So, you know, that size that the people use, like, you know, it's we're on a 3 nanometer process or a 4 nanometer process. If you go back a few years, that size typically represented the gate length, or, you know, the distance the electrons had to travel underneath a gate that controlled whether they could travel there or not. For a long time, that number really hasn't meant anything physical, because it's just a marketing number mostly that says, hey, look, I'm calling this 3 nanometer because the previous generation I called 4 nanometer. It might be that there's nothing on the chip that's actually 3 nanometers in size. But, you know, things are getting smaller, and there's two parts to that. One is that the transistors and the gate lengths are getting smaller, but also the wiring between these transistors is getting smaller and tighter. And that helps also because the shorter and smaller the wires are, the less load or, you know, parasitics they represent. And so you're able to speed up the chip or do the design more energy efficient because of that. I don't know enough to know when that limit's going to hit. You know, people have been projecting the end of that for a long time. You know, I'm not sure what folks like ASML are working on in terms of lithography in order to get smaller sizes. I'll say one thing, that the average distance between silicon atoms in a crystal is about somewhere about 0.35 nanometers. So if you really did have a 3 nanometer gate, that would be just 10 silicon atoms wide. Now, the actual distance between silicon atoms is different depending on which planes you're looking at, but the average distance is about a third of a nanometer. So if you have a 3 nanometer device, you have roughly 9 to 10 silicon atoms. That actually brings up one of the limitations that people don't talk about, is that when you make things very small, making them precise and the same from one to the next to the next to the next becomes much, much harder. So let's just take this. If the thing really was just 3 nanometers across, meaning 10 atoms, if you got even just one atom out of place or different, you'd have a 10% error right there, right? And so the variability from transistor to transistor becomes very large as you go to smaller processes. And that's one of the things that you have to accommodate. And that actually makes it much harder to design in these smaller technologies, because if you don't account for the fact that you have effectively a huge variability, then you'll get very low yield in your chips. And low yield means high cost. So
Interesting.
it's becoming increasingly difficult to work with smaller processes. You have to
Yeah.
be more creative. And the variability is probably as much of a problem as anything else.
I mean, it increases cost as well, right? If the failure rate goes up, then it increases cost to
Right.
produce the chips.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then you wonder where the break even is, right? Before for Bitcoin mining chips, where how much sense does it make to push from a commercial perspective, to push the efficiency further and further and further, if it increases
Well, I
cost
think
exponentially, potentially.
so. I think we have to be clear that in the past and up to this date, efficiency has been largely connected to which process node and how small those transistors are, right? And that's really because the circuit design hasn't changed much in the last 10 years since 2014. What we're proposing with the SEAL04 is a completely new circuit design. So it's far less dependent on having that latest node of process to get that efficiency. And so that's the thing. The creativity is, you know, TSMC and Samsung and the others have put in billions, I'd say tens or hundreds of billions of dollars into moving that node down. But that's a level playing field for people like us who all have access to that technology. Where we add value is saying, okay, how can we put this together? How can we do the circuit design in a more creative way? And I think there's been not nearly enough attention paid to that. And I think there's a huge amount that you can do there. It's very difficult. It takes some of the smartest people in the chip space, but I think that's where the big payoffs are, not in continuing to follow, you know, the latest processing node.
It's maybe correct me if I'm wrong here, but what it makes me think, Harris, is that you're kind of flipping the table, right? You can afford it. You've got another business line. You're saying, hey, let's rethink ASICs. Everybody's sort of following this one track and racing down that track as fast as they can, while maybe a much longer track will lead to a much better outcome around the way. Nobody's following that path, and you guys are saying, hey, let's see what's out there. And you're actually seeing you can see land now, right? And everybody's
Yeah,
sort of fully invested
it's a
on
much
making
more
running
difficult
down
path.
there, yeah, running
Yeah.
down there as quickly as they can, while going the other route might actually also be an option.
Yeah, well, we're actually following both paths, right? We have teams in Singapore following the path of, hey, let's use the latest node, and we have a team in the US that's looking at far more creative ways of design. So the trade-off is this, is that you get this huge energy efficiency improvement, but the design techniques are so difficult that very few circuit designers are capable of understanding them, let alone doing them. And second, the existing design methodology that uses, you know, electronic design automation tools from companies like Cadence and Synopsys, those don't work very well because the circuits don't look like the circuits that everyone else uses. And so you have to develop a lot of the software for doing circuit design as well as the circuit design. And, you know, it's a much, much harder path. It requires a lot more effort, a lot more skill, but the payoff is huge. And we think it's worth doing.
Briefly, because we're running up on time already, this time has flew past me. We've talked a lot about the chips, the boards that they go on, Harris. What are sort of the most important aspects when it comes to the boards themselves that the chips live on? Is there anything to look out for?
The boards are actually very different from everyone else's boards at any other digital chip. But there's two main problems you have to deal with. One is getting the heat off of the chip. And so that's the chip package and then the board, right? And I think there's a lot of creativity that we can bring to bear there also, especially if we know that it's going to be liquid cooled or immersion cooled or things like that. I think that, you know, just taking an air cooled machine and removing the fans and dunking it in immersion liquid is, you know, like a zeroth order thing there. If you know you're going to do that, I think there's a lot more that can be done in the board design. So one thing is, how do you remove the heat? That's a big thing, and that's a problem. The second thing is, how do you deliver power to the chips? Because the power has to be delivered at very low voltage. You know, the chips are only operating at 2 or 3 tenths of a volt, which means that the current that's going into them is huge. You could have 40 amps going into a single chip. And that requires very, very low resistance pathway for the current. And otherwise, you'll end up burning up a lot of power just in the resistances of those power and ground connections. So those are the two main issues with Bitcoin. And the other way is Bitcoin boards are very easy. There's no high-speed signals. There's very few signals to begin with. And so all those things that, you know, are problematic for other electronics designers are sort of not a problem at all. But power and removing heat, those are, you know, the two main things.
Man, I could sit here and talk to you for hours, Harris. I think this has been really, really insightful. Last but not least, before you tell people where they can find you and Bitdia if they have no doubt more questions, what do you think? Does Bitcoin consume enough energy or no?
Enough energy? Well, I think that's a very subjective question and depends on what you think about Bitcoin. I think that my job is to make hash rate consume less energy. And so that's my goal, you know, and to be more efficient. So, and I think, you know, we're going to go a long ways over the next few months and years in doing that. But I think it's valuable to society for the energy that is consumed. So I'll let other people decide whether what's too much energy or too little.
Perfect. Thank you. Where can people find you? Where can they find Bitdia, Aris? Where do you want them to go?
Well, Bitdia is bitdia.com. And I'm not really a creature of social media. So, you know, I've got a LinkedIn page. You could try that. And that's probably the best way of trying to reach me if you don't, you know, or just reach out to IR, you know, investor relations, ir.bitdia.com. And it's a contact link there. You can reach me that way.
Perfect. Guys, no doubt everybody that listened to this, what felt like 15 minutes, but actually was close to an hour, learned something new. If you did, you know what to do. Thank you, Harris, so much for your time. This was really, really insightful.
Thank you, Jesse.
I have to have you guys back once the announcement come out for the CeLo 2 and the CeLo 3. Maybe we can delve deeper into the boards that time. Was a blast. Thank you so much. Folks, please have a look at the show notes. Again, if you learned something new, you know what to do. Next up, I believe, is Foreman next Sunday. Catch Harris in Nashville if you're going in July. That might also be an option to have a quick sidebar and ask him some detailed questions about chip design. I'm sure he will happily answer those.
Yeah, I think I'm speaking at Nashville also.
Oh, so, you're speaking. Cool. Yeah, great.
Yeah.
Brilliant. Is it going? Are you going to talk about this?
Yeah, it's going to be about energy and ASICs. So yeah, similar topic.
All right. I'll have to tune into the live stream. Make sure you're there. If you're there, shake hands, say hi. And yeah, I'll see you next Sunday. Bye-bye.